You're listening to a podcast from 702 and Cape Talk.
Eusebius Makaiser on 702 and Cape Talk.
Remember that traditional courts bill? Well, you may be forgiven for not remembering it, because there used to be a time when there was relentless public scrutiny of the traditional courts bill, and that just kind of like tapered off. But it is still in legislative play, and that is why it's important that we need to return to some of the debates about what in it is defensible, constitutionally acceptable, and which bits and pieces is still deeply problematic. And one of the experts on this particular issue, who, when she was at UCT, but also since the days from Oxford, have really been concerned with how we square the different elements of our constitutional edifice. On the one hand, this liberal normative document, but also the reality of millions of South Africans actually also being governed by more traditional courts away from the big cities, is Dr. Sindiso Mnisi-Weeks, who's also an assistant professor now based in America at the Public Policy of Excluded Populations at the School for Global Inclusion and Social Development at the University of Massachusetts in Boston. And she's in the country in part because she has an amazing book out, and we're going to have her back on the show in the next couple of weeks once I've properly read the book. And then we'll talk more fully about the book project. But today I'd invited her on, and I'm grateful she had time, despite a short trip to the country, to speak to us specifically about the traditional courts bill. She joins us now in our Cape Talk studio in Cape Town. Sindiso, good morning to you.
Good morning, Eusebius.
How are you, darling?
I am very well. How about you?
I'm very good. It's wonderful to hear your voice.
You too.
Yeah, and welcome, welcome, even if thank it's a brief you. Stay back in Cape Town.
Thank you.
I want us to go back to the beginning, and just before we get to the present, remind folks what the design purpose of the traditional courts bill was in the first place.
So the traditional courts have been governed since 1927 by the Black Administration Act. And of course, the date of 1927 tells you that it is very old and very out of date with the reality of traditional courts right now. And in fact, it was always out of step with the way that traditional courts function. For instance, it recognizes the traditional court in terms of a single chief or headman as being essentially the judge in that forum. And so the court is constituted based on this individual, which is what state court judges are, state courts are, but not necessarily traditional courts. And so that and a number of different things have led, or in fact necessitated, that a change be made and legislation be brought into being that is more consistent, firstly, with the fact that we are now in a democratic constitutional era. And then secondly, we want to value and actually recognize traditional forums and traditional communities in terms of the way that they actually exist, and recognize their right to exist in terms of their cultural identities. And that is what the traditional courts bill was supposed to do.
But now, if I remember a lot of the problems that had been flagged by so many academics and commentators like yourself, there were a range of them with the initial reading of the bill. They included, for example, as you've now alluded to, worries that in fact gender inequality could be exacerbated because of the patriarchal arrangement that we find in the customary communities around the country, not that urban centers are exempt, but also that the opportunity for the kind of accountability mechanism built into, for example, the appeals processes here in Johannesburg, a high court in Cape Town, that you don't have the same level of check over the authority and power of the quote-unquote senior traditional leaders. How were the raft of problems that had been written about, not just in the academy, but also in the popular media like Mail and Guardian by many of you, did the state ever seriously think about those criticisms and rethink the original version of the bill? Was any progress ever made?
Well, it took a while. I would remind your listeners that the bill was initially introduced in 2008, and there was a consultation process in which, as you aptly described, in that process, lots of people came forward. And I would add that it was not just people who actually study this and work with this, but also people who actually live this. And so, you know, there was a massive outcry, people saying this doesn't represent our reality and it's not going to help address the problems that we do face in real life. But at that time, the legislature was not so keen on actually taking on board the criticisms. It thought that these were just anecdotal, evidence and, couldn't be relied upon. Maybe it was a few bad apples. And so they, decided that they would engage in a more robust consultative process than is possible necessarily in the National Assembly. And so they reintroduced the legislation in 2012, exactly as it was, but this time in the National Council of Provinces, so that the provincial delegates would be able to go out and get their provinces' votes on the legislation. Through that process, then, the provinces predominantly either said this is not a very good bill and it needs to be changed, or we reject this bill outright because it's actually not possible to save it. And that is how we get to the point at which we now have a different bill, which is the Traditional Courts Bill that was introduced in 2017 in January last year. And that legislation, I've got to say, is vastly improved compared to the initial version that was introduced in 2008 and 2012. However, there are still some problems that need to be addressed, as you pointed out.
Okay, we're going to examine those very, very closely. Before we take a break and then hit the pause button over the remaining concerns, Cindy. So just tell us from a legislative process, just factually, so where are we at now? Are we 5 minutes away from this thing being an act?
You know, it's unclear. If you had asked me in March, I would have said, oh, we're actually, you know, on the fast track now, because there were 3 days of hearings. Initially, it was just the 13th and 14th, but then the Portfolio Committee on Justice and Correctional Services then scheduled a third day, which was March 20th. But after that, the chair had actually said, you know, based on the conversation that and all of the consultation feedback, they would have wanted to have people back. But then, of course, there was this new sort of investigation that was put together, and much of the Portfolio Committee is involved in that process, looking into expropriation and the property clause in the Constitution. And so it seems that that process has kind of overtaken the process around the Traditional Courts Bill. So we're really just waiting to see what's going to happen. But it doesn't look like it's necessarily imminent, but it could be.
Sandisa, I want to ask you another preliminary question before we talk about remaining concerns after our commercial break. How critically important is this conversation? In other words, there's plenty of bits of legislation, draft legislation, constantly going through the legislative process. You are deeply passionate about this particular issue, and not just as a social legal expert going back to your graduate student days at UCT and at Oxford. You've also written a book that try and grapple with similar kind of things as Lungisele does as well. So sociologists at UCT, how we square cultural contradictions in rural South Africa, which incidentally is the subtitle of Sandiso's book, Access to Justice and Human Security. For people who are listening to this conversation, if we can just step back for a couple of seconds, how crucial is this discussion about the quality of this bill? What's at stake here truly?
I'm so glad that you asked that question, Eusebius, because I think that it does get lost a lot of the time. People maybe think that, oh, you know, we are naysayers who, you know, hate traditional leaders or hate traditional systems. I have immense regard for traditional systems, and I actually, you know, have essentially staked my career and staked my life on defending people's right to culture and wanting to ensure that within the constitutional framework, people's right to culture is able to be expressed in ways that are both going to protect their rights, and specifically, especially the rights of the vulnerable within traditional communities, but also then allow them to express themselves, to self-determine, to articulate their own identities in ways that are true for them. But that means that you know, there's some power struggles in that context, because people's ideas of what is and isn't our culture vary. Some people are deeply committed to this ideal of pre-colonial traditional arrangements. But the reality is that our notion of what pre-colonial traditional arrangements is actually in many ways quite different from what they actually were like. And so when you look at anthropological research and you look at archaeological data, you realize that actually, you know, they were much, they were not, for instance, necessarily subject to having a traditional leader. In fact, there were a lot of what the technical term is acephalous, but that literally means headless, traditional communities. And so why is it that our legislation, whether it's the traditional courts bill or the traditional leadership and governance framework act, which predates it, or the traditional, and Khoisan leadership bill, which is presently in the works, to replace the traditional leadership and governance framework act. All of those pieces of legislation presume that a traditional community can only exist if it has a senior traditional leader at its head. But that is contrary to the essential nature of traditional communities as they existed pre-colonially. And so I think that it's really important for the legislation to be true to our cultures, but also true to the democratic ideals of our country.
14 minutes before noon. Fascinating. The current version of the traditional courts bill, there's been some improvements, major concerns. I'm in conversation with assistant professor from University of Massachusetts Boston, Dr. Sindiso Mnisi-Weeks. And on the other side of this spot break, I'm going to ask her how women are affected by the current version of this bill and what some of the other problems are that were concerns with earlier versions, such as boundaries in terms of jurisdiction. And I hope that the parliamentary committee that is in charge of this bill will invite Dr. Mnisi-Weeks to come and, as an expert, give input, or at the very least, listen very closely to this conversation.
Eusebius Mkhize on your number one news and talk station.
11 minutes before noon. We've got about 8 of those minutes left, and we're talking about the current version of the traditional courts bill. What potential constitutional or other defects remain despite the fact that there have been some changes over the years? And I'm speaking to Sindiso about that. Sindiso Mnisi-Weeks, who's an expert in this particular area. Sindiso, can we be practical about this? Now, my memory may be not as sharp as yours here, not least because this is not my area of expertise. I thought one of the problems with the original bill when it comes to the gender equity question is that women are excluded in all sorts of way from the adjudication processes when it comes to the traditional systems of law that are enforced in the rural parts of the country. What is the current state of play in terms of this particular bill through the lens of gender equality, which presumably the Constitution mandates this bill to be consistent with?
Your memory serves you very well, Eusebius. So you're absolutely right. One of the concerns was that women were not provided for adequately, whether in terms of their participation as members of traditional courts, in other words, being able to hear matters and participate in deliberations and decision making, or as litigants, and so being able to actually come before the forums and present their cases in a way that suits their needs. And both of those concerns are things that I must admit have been taken quite seriously, I think, in the process of drafting the traditional courts bill that we have before us right now. However, that does not mean that they are beyond controversy, because even though the traditional courts bill of 2017 does provide that women should be able to participate, and it allows for women, in fact, it specifically says that women should be allowed to be members of the traditional court, it doesn't actually give any indication on, you know, a specific number, for instance, where Whereas the Traditional Leadership and Governance Framework Act of 2003, which is the sort of framework act for all traditional law matters in South Africa for present purposes, it actually provides for a quota. It says that at least a third of the women should be, a third of the members of the traditional council should be women. And so why is there not such a similar requirement? And of course, you know, we would say that there should be more than a third, given that most of people living in rural areas today are women, and that, you know, so that should be reflected. But additionally, one of the things that was very concerning in the Traditional Courts Bill of 2008 and 2012 was that women were said basically the phrasing was technically that a person who appears before a traditional court cannot be represented by a lawyer, but can be represented, a man can represent a woman according to customary law, basically. And so the reality is that customary law never allows a woman to represent a man, or at least it virtually never. But women are always represented by men. And so that was a concern that was raised. But that is something that was removed, thankfully. But now the wording is very vague. It sort of says, you know, that a person can be represented by whomever they please. But what if a person actually wants to represent themselves? What if a woman wants to represent herself? And it seems like that's not even part of the plausibility framework within this bill. So I would say that there are still some things that need to be addressed with respect to considering women's rights.
So from the point of view of the most hygienic, ordinary English language crafting of a bill, which is ideally what one looks for if you are a good legislator, you would like the bill to expressly make it clear that a woman may well represent herself, so that you don't have some patriarch trying to say, no, this wording clearly meant that the legislature intended women to elect a man to do so.
Absolutely. I mean, I know we're not talking about my book right now, but actually my book opens with a story about a woman who appears before a chief's court and has to be represented by her brother. And it just so happens that her brother is not a very sort of strong personality. And so he actually does a relatively poor job of representing her. And yet, you know, she's required to be represented by a male. And actually many women in the first iteration of the traditional courts bill process came forward and said the problem with being required to be, being allowed to be represented by any other person according to customary law is that firstly, customary law only requires men to represent women, never the other way around. But secondly, often women are left stranded because they don't have an appropriate person to represent them. And so, for instance, you know, if you have lost all of your male kin and you're in a conflict with your in-laws over property grabbing, because when your husband passed away, they decided that they needed to claim the property as their family property and you couldn't have access to it. Where are you supposed to go to get good representation? Why can you not represent yourself?
That's right. Let's talk about jurisdiction. What is the jurisdiction? If I accidentally find myself getting stuck in a skorokoro in the Eastern Cape on my way to Durban through some chief's territory, will I be subject to his jurisdiction? Has the jurisdiction boundary question be settled? That's the first prong of the question. The second one is, can I opt out if I ordinarily am resident?
Great questions as well. So with respect to the jurisdiction, one of the concerns with the traditional courts bill still is that it is based on the Traditional Leadership and Governance Framework Act definition of a traditional leader. And so the person who can sort of convene a court is a traditional leader. And that traditional leader is one who is defined according to the boundaries that are essentially, and I won't go into the details of the actual mechanism through which they are, but they are essentially the boundaries that were established by apartheid legislation, the 1951 Bantu Authorities Act, to be precise. And so actually, in that situation, it means, firstly, going back to this idea of the fact that traditional communities pre-colonially actually did exist without heads in many instances, it would mean that if you don't have a head, you can't have a traditional court that's recognized. And then secondly, it would mean that if you don't actually recognize that head, there is an issue on when he calls you to come to this forum, do you have to come or do you not have to come, right? And if, for instance, your head was appointed, your traditional leader was appointed through, you know, apartheid processes, and you actually as a community do not recognize them as legitimate, right? Should you still have to go to that forum for your matters to be heard? This has been a hotly contested issue. People saying, considering the fact that in Limpopo alone, there are over 600 conflicts over traditional community boundaries, over traditional leadership titles, etc., is it reasonable to say that people are compelled to go to the traditional court that is assigned to their traditional community and the traditional leader chairing that court who is assigned to their traditional community? And of course, the answer is no, it is not reasonable. And so opting out becomes essential. And that's not even to mention that, you know, considering your skorokoro in the Eastern Cape, you know, if you are going through there, if you cannot opt out, it means regardless of the fact that you're not a member of the community and consequently do not know the norms and laws of that community that you have violated, you are still required to go to that court. But the thing is that the traditional courts bill now allows you to opt out, but it doesn't say you can opt in. It says you have to opt out. And, you know, that depends on whether the clerk tells you that you have the right to opt out, whether you are, assisted or, you know, under duress to stay participating in the process. So all sorts of complexities there, but the, chair, and the committee in the hearings seemed to be very unhappy with the idea of allowing people to opt out because they say it undermines the legitimacy and authority of traditional courts. And so that's a battle that still needs to be fought.
Well, I certainly hope they're going to call you to come and give input. Final question, a quick one, just in a minute or less that's left, because when we do your book interview, this is going to be a big part of our discussion when I interview you about the book. Given all these detailed problems in terms of the patriarchal nature, the contradictions in terms of jurisdiction, etc., etc., in essence, do you think that the liberal crux of the constitution is merely in tension with what happens in the rural areas? Or do you think we have here, as some people like sociologist Dr. Ntsebeza thinks, a fundamental ideological contradiction?
I think it's both. I think that there's a way in which there's a fundamental intellectual conflict insofar as, you know, epistemologically, right, in terms of sort of philosophy and view of worldview, how you see the world, how you think of being. The Constitution is embedded in a different framework from communal systems that we're talking about when we talk about customary law. So that's fundamental. However, I think that there are ways that you can kind of bring them together and resolve some of those tensions where, for instance, the idea of a right is not unique to the Constitution or to Western systems of law. There are rights in customary communities. It's just that we need to think about them in a different way. And so I think that there's tensions that can be resolved there, even as we continue to think about how do we make the legal system at large as an edifice reflect both sort of philosophical positions that come from the Western order in which our, you know, Roman Dutch system of law is from and the traditional way of seeing the world.
Brilliant. Thanks for coming on. Looking forward to our book interview. Thank you so much for today.
Thank you.